tuned into the greatest.
You are now tuned into the greatest.
Oh my God.
It's the Fearless Podcast with Arian Simone.
Hey, everybody, I'm Arian Simone. I am your podcast host right here at Fearless. But in addition to that, I'm also the Fearless founder and CEO. I'm an entrepreneur, an investor, a motivational speaker that speaks internationally, a best-selling author, and just an overall, I guess you'll say, very down-to-earth person, lover of positive vibes and good energy. Here at Fearless, we have three different sectors. We have our Fearless brand, which the podcast falls under. We have our Fearless fund, our venture arm, and our Fearless foundation, our philanthropic arm. So we look forward to you getting to know much more about what we have going on in all areas of Fearless, and I hope you enjoy them all. We are here to serve and very proud of it. We are on now with Robin and Andrea for season three of the Fearless Podcast, and it's our entrepreneurship series. And I had to have you guys on to definitely share your journey about how you guys even met, even though you are sisters, and how this business even came about. They are the founders of McBride Sisters Wine. They are the number one African-American winemakers in the country. And as far as I'm concerned, it's some of the best wine you will ever, ever have.
Yes.
Guys, no, I'm serious. I am always up at Kroger like, where's McBride Sisters? I have to know. Point me right, left. Where am I going?
We appreciate you. Thank you. Love
your wine. Well, I'm going to let you guys start this story off. I don't even know where to say where to start from because they start in two different places, two different countries, which I know you guys are so used to telling this so many times. But I want the listeners to have the full backstory of how you guys met and then pretty much how this business came about. And I may interject it, intertwine in there to ask a few questions, but I'm going to let you all take it away.
Yeah. So I think, we'll start with our sisterhood because our business is definitely can only be thought about, you know, when we look at like our sisterhood and how we came together. So the backstory is that, and this is Andrea speaking, is that Robin and I grew up in completely different parts of the world. I grew up at the bottom of the Southern Hemisphere in this little country called New Zealand. And Robin was growing up in Monterey, California. And we were united and we met for the first time in 1999. So a lot of people were like, huh? What? how is this possible? So the backstory to that is that we share the same father. We have different mothers. And the way that we like to describe our daddy is he was a Rolling Stone. And so Robin and her mom lived in Los Angeles. Robin was born in L.A., was married to her dad. And, you know, we like to say he's an interesting character.
Mm-hmm. You know what? This story is like Parent Trap 2.0, but the black version. Right?
Yes. Yes. And so Robin's mama wasn't sort of, you know, having that and wanting to deal with our daddy. So at the age of two, she packed up Robin and they moved from Los Angeles, north of Los Angeles to a small town called Monterey. And so her mom and our dad would break ties and there was no communication. So they had no idea that, you know, nine years later, he had remarried, met my mother, and I was born. Now, our daddy was still that interesting character. And quickly, my mom.
Okay, Robin, chime in, give the real.
Well, I mean, you have to set the setting. So, you know, our father was just like, you know, 6'6", dark and handsome, from Alabama, living in Los Angeles. This is in the 70s when I was born. He's an actor. I'm using air quotes, but he's an actor, right? So that's what he's doing. He's in Hollywood. you know, he's definitely getting by, going through life with his good looks and his charm. You know, when he got married and had a baby, he still liked to get around using his good looks and his charm, and, you know, didn't really ever graduate to becoming a good father, you know, a good husband. So my mom was like, oh no, this isn't going to work. You know, you can't be out doing whatever's going on in 70s Hollywood, you know, Black Hollywood isn't what I signed up for. So she wiped her hands of that. Apparently that was still going on in the 80s.
Yeah. And then so my mom was originally from New Zealand, and unfortunately she was terminal with breast cancer, diagnosed at a pretty young age. So at the age of 6, she decided, after they had separated, to take me from Los Angeles down to New Zealand, to a place called Blenheim. The region's called Marlborough. It happens to be a pretty big agricultural wine growing area. And so unfortunately she would pass away there. I would lose, you know, communication with our dad. And so, you know, we just didn't know about each other. And, you know, Robin was also growing up in Monterey, which is like an agriculture, like wine growing area. And, fast forward to, you know, 1995, you know, I'd been in New Zealand since 1989. I ended up going into foster care and, was at my foster family's home and came home from school and the phone rang and I was closest to it. So I picked it up and, this person like on the other end of the phone said, "Hey, is this Andrea?" And I was like, "Yeah." And, the person said, "It's your daddy." And I was like, "Oh," and you know, in this conversation, you know, he just told me that, you know, he'd just gotten out of prison and that he had a terminal illness, and in addition to that, you know, the silver lining of the conversation, because obviously it's pretty heavy. I think I was like 12 at the time. Was that I had this big sister and her name was Robin McBride, and his family was, our family was trying to find her. So they found me first, and unfortunately he would pass away in 1996. But his family like took it upon themselves to see through his final wish was to find and connect his two daughters. So fast forward to Christmas time, 1999, I fly from New Zealand to Montgomery, Alabama. I'm with our dad's family. I go to a little place just outside of Montgomery called Camden, which is very close to Selma. And I'm sitting in our aunt's living room and the phone rings. And I just remember my aunt screaming and calling on Jesus. And the reason for that was Robin was on the other end of the phone. So our family had, since the time our dad passed away, anywhere where they could get a name, an exact name, Robin McBride, and they could get an address, they were handwriting letters and sending them out across the country. And it just so happened that not even like a week before I got to the United States, Robin had received this letter that was written by our auntie, kind of laying it out saying, "Unfortunately, your father's passed away. I'm your auntie. You have this really big family. We want to know you. And by the way, you have a little sister. She lives in this country called New Zealand. Please call us." And just as God would have it, Robin called and typically and called her auntie. Typically, I would be halfway across the world, you know, but it just happened. I was sitting in her living room and Robin was calling from Atlanta, Georgia. So we were at that time like 3 hours away from each other. Any other 99% of the time, any time other than that, we would have been, you know, 7 miles away from each other. 7 miles, 7,000 miles.
How about
sorry.
Her 7,000?
Yeah.
Right.
And so really quickly, you know, we talked, and it's funny because I don't really have a New Zealand accent anymore. It's a little bit.
You don't think so?
She doesn't.
No, not so much. I think, you know, everybody from New Zealand says I sound very American. I remember, you know, like talking, and I just remember Rob being so quiet, and I was just like so excited. Like my auntie like threw the phone at me, and she was like, "It's your sister! It's your sister!" And I just remembered like talking to her, being so excited, and thinking to myself like, "Wow, she is so quiet." And then it wasn't until like later on, like Robin told me, she's like, I had no idea like what you were saying. She was like, she was like, your accent was so thick and strong. Cause I remember thinking like, she just kept on saying, And, but anyway, luckily, Robin, you know, I mean, I think it takes a lot of guts. Like, you know, now like we hear a lot of stories of, you know, through all these DNA tests, people finding that they have half siblings, and, you know, it's usually kind of under scandalous circumstances, you know. You know, sometimes people, you know, parents have stepped out for a little bit of time and somebody was conceived or whatever it is. But, you know, Robin, like, was just like, now I'm going to pick up the phone and call. And the next day I was scheduled to go see more family in New York. So Robin like called into work sick, and I was flying into LaGuardia Airport in New York, and she got on a flight from Atlanta and flew into LaGuardia, and we met for the first time in LaGuardia Airport, and that was in 1999, and that was the beginning of the McBride sisters.
That is just so beautiful. So what was the reaction when you guys saw each other's face?
It was different, I think, than what most people expect, like our answer. Well, first of all, so I was coming into New York. Andrea was there with our father's family, with aunts and uncles, or uncles and cousins. And so I had no idea. We had not seen each other. We had not seen pictures of each other at that point, right? So I don't know, like, I'm biracial. Is she biracial? I don't know. I know she's at least half Black, I'm assuming, but I have no idea. I have no idea what to expect. I have no idea who to look for. And so
people have to remember, this is before social media. This is before technology. Like, your families were writing letters.
Writing letters, like, with their hand and a pen. So we didn't know what to expect. We didn't know who we were looking for. And coming off of the plane, which my plane was delayed, it was winter, there was all kinds of weather and things going on, so it was nerve-wracking already, and then it just got prolonged. So by the time I got off, you know, I'm trying to get my mind right and trying to be prepared for anything, because like the reality is these people could be crazy. I don't know who I'm about to meet, really, honestly. Just popped up out of nowhere, and I flew myself to New York to go find out, you know, who they are. So I'm talking to myself and walking off of the plane, and at the end of the jetway, I see what I think is my reflection at the end of the jetway. And as I'm walking and talking to myself, I'm realizing that my reflection is not walking as I'm walking, and that I'm actually seeing Andrea for the first time, who in fact is also biracial, and who does actually look quite a lot like me. And we, you know, clearly recognized each other as sisters. We were also like fitted out in all kinds of 90s gear. We like always wear the same things, but we were dressed like boys basically. But so we saw each other, like, what do you say in that moment? You know, I don't think there was any prepared words, so we didn't say anything. We just looked at each other and we hugged, and we cried, and we just stood there and embraced for, I really couldn't tell you how long, minutes, I guess, I don't know, for a long time. And then at a certain point, we kind of stepped back, and it was like, hi, you must be Andrea, right? And we were like, oh yeah, we should make sure that we are hugging the right person.
I had to ask, because I know the audience right now, they are just looking for their tissue. I think that encounter is just so divine and just so beautiful. And I'm so happy all this just came together. This is just amazing to me. So that's how your sisterhood started. So let's fast forward. How did your business start? Did you guys, you know what, let's rewind just for a second. Did you all individually always grow up knowing that you would be an entrepreneur?
What's funny, Ariana, is like I always grew up, and I don't know if it's like the cloth that I was cut from, but I always knew I was going to be a boss. I always knew, like, I always knew I was going to be an entrepreneur, and I hoped that, you know, that it would be in the wine business. But it actually didn't start that way. So it was, you know, both Robin and I grew up, you know, in and around the wine business, but it kind of, for, I think, especially for people of color, you know, like they're historically, you know, we don't have families that have legacies that go back 300 or 400 years where there's a chateau and vineyards and it's like handed down generation to generation, you know? So that type of idea, I feel like for people of color and for women is something that you shouldn't dare dream about because, it's impossible, you know? And the way that Robin and I, how we met, it was so divine, like you said. It was so serendipitous that the fact that we both grew up in wine regions and wanting to be in the wine business, that was one of the things that we first connected on when we met, you know. It was kind of like post getting, like, you know, home from the airport and like sitting down and like looking at each other. The first natural question is like, you know, where did you grow up? What was it like? And the fact that like these two little like towns on like the opposite side of the world that were just so similar, and we like had this
identical
and had the same interests, you know, that thing that seemed impossible felt like it was possible because there was this divine interaction going on. There was this serendipity, you know, that we couldn't ignore. And so when we met, I was 16. So I had to go back to New Zealand and graduate high school. And a part of me coming back to the U.S. for university was driven by wanting to be close to my sister, you know, and coming back to California, like that was my purpose. And then, Robin moved, back from Atlanta to Monterey. So we just found ourselves a lot of the time, you know, I was in LA driving up to Monterey and Robin driving down to LA. Sometimes we'd meet halfway in between and we would often find ourselves, you know, just kicking it and hanging out, but just driving and getting lost, you know. And then we would do this thing that we call like driving and dreaming, where we'd just kind of be like driving to nowhere, but you know, just kind of talking about like our dreams out loud and like what we wanted to do. And then it wasn't until really like my junior year of college when I was like, oh damn, like I gotta earn some money, like as soon as I leave here, you know, that we started to kind of talk about like, well, you know, why don't we do this? Like, what would it take for us to get into the wine industry? Like how much money is it really? Like, what do we need to know? Like, what skills do we have? How can we make it happen? And it was really just those like beginning conversations that we dared to entertain, that we dared to be fearless, right?
Yes.
And right. And just say and look at it like, why not? Why not us? You know?
Because you guys are about what, 15 years in now? How many years?
Yeah.
You are?
15
yeah.
years.
Okay.
Yeah, 15 years. So it really just started with that, just realizing, I think, one, that that we were worthy. I don't know if worthy is the right word, Robin, but like, you know, just feeling like that we could do it and we could figure it out, and that we loved it that much that we knew that it wasn't ever going to be easy, but we were going to figure out a way to learn the business of wine. We were going to learn how to make wine, and we were going to make it happen.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just going to add, I think that the key difference, because like we're often asked, would we be doing this if we had not met each other? And the answer is probably not.
Yeah.
But I think that the key thing is that at the time, you know, there's a few, you know, women of color, we didn't know about them, but they're out there somewhere, right? But I think that the key thing for us is that we didn't see anybody else, but we saw each other and we felt like together it's something that we could accomplish on our own. If we felt like we were the only ones, you know, in the industry, if we had to be the ones, you know, solely to have to do some of the, you know, barrier breaking that we did, might not have attempted to do it, but together, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful. So you guys did mention that, okay, when you look at the industry, okay, we don't have a chateau that's being passed down. We don't have all the same resources. So with that being said, what was your route to getting this started?
So I think what was critical for us was, you know, had we been trying to do this, the McBride sisters, 10 years earlier, so let's say in like 1985, I don't think we couldn't have done it, because what was life-changing for us was the internet. So and what I mean by that is the democratization of information. So, you know, so the wine industry for a long time is, you know, it's family run, you know, it's pretty closed, you know, and so unless you have come from that or you're granted access, you know, into these sort of smaller circles, that information wasn't freely shared. I think, you know, with the internet, a lot of that information became a lot more accessible to people like us. And so what we were able to do was figure out what was the best place for us to start in the wine business that was the least capital intensive, right? Mm-hmm. And so at the time in California, the wine and spirits industry is incredibly regulated in the United States. It's anywhere else in the world, it's completely different. A lot of the laws go back to prohibition. And so we were able to like gain all this information just, you know, on the internet, and figure out that the best place for us to start would be to learn the business of selling wine. And we tell everybody that we meet, this is the most important thing that you need to learn when it comes to your passion. It doesn't matter if it's wine, it doesn't matter if it's cupcakes, it doesn't matter if it's clothing, because the passion and the business are two completely different things. And so where we started was we got an importer's license to import wine from New Zealand. And what we did was we went down to New Zealand and reached out to a bunch of small, you know, winery folks, and basically just said, don't put all your eggs in our basket, but we think like California could be a great export market for you. Give us really long payment terms and we'll sell your product and we promise we'll pay you back. And the import license cost us $1,500, which was like all the money we had in the world when we started. What long payment terms like means, like for your listeners that aren't familiar with that, is we could import the product and then we didn't have to pay for that product until 120 days later. And so what that allowed us to do was bring in the product, go knock, literally Google top restaurants in California, you know, go knock on doors, try and sell the product, collect the money, pay the light bill, and then pay the people back in New Zealand. And then a part of that deal was that every year we would go down and they would during harvest and they would teach us how to make wine. So we started that in 2005, and then we ended up getting a distributor license after that. And then we got a license where we could sell directly to consumers online. And then by 2009, was a time in which, you know, we had, done well with our importing and distribution company, and we made our first vintage of wine, and then we established our wine company in 2010.
I think this is just so awesome. Now, one time when I heard Robin tell the story, you guys were knocking on doors until your feet were bleeding.
in San Francisco. So
When Andrea is talking about looking at, you know, Google and finding the top restaurants, we decided San Francisco has a bunch of amazing restaurants and wine bars. And so we're going to take our wines there and we're going to go sell them. And so we looked up, you know, on Google Maps where all the restaurants and hotels and stuff were in San Francisco. And we, you know, traveled up, got a really nasty, like, cheap hotel, got our finest wares and our heels, you know, so that we would look good while we're
trying to look cute, you know, while we're selling our wine.
Yeah, you can't be out there looking busted. No one's going to buy wine from some busted people. So we got ourselves extra cute. And then, but what we didn't realize when we're looking at Google Maps is that that is a flat. It does not show elevation. So when we set out at the bottom, if anybody's familiar, been to San Francisco, knows what California Street looks like, that is a, I don't know what degree angle, straight up a hill. So we get ourselves ready in the morning and we're standing at the bottom of this hill and we have, you know, each of us have 30, 40 pounds of wine in different bags that we're holding with these heels. And we're like, we look at each other like, we're here now, right? We're not going to go back. And so we spent the whole day walking from, you know, one side of the street up this enormous hill in San Francisco, going into restaurant, hotel, wine shop, wine bar, trying to sell our wines. And we weren't going to quit until, you know, we had gone to every single one, which was basically all day and all night. And we didn't sell a thing that day.
We sure didn't.
But that's because we didn't know what we were doing also. So yeah. We just thought you could walk in with an amazing product and say, hey, Mr. Owner, look at this amazing wine. You're going to love it. And then they'll buy it, which is not what happens. It's a much more complex system of getting to see the appropriate person who's going to buy the wine. So it was a very invaluable lesson. But by the end of the day, and we got back to our little funky hotel where we were sleeping on the same bed and kicked off our super cute heels, and there was literally blood in our shoes from walking that hill and back down the hill carrying all of that heavy wine. And we just looked at each other like, you know, this is not what's up. This can't be it. We didn't sell anything. Our feet are bleeding. Like, you know, we're doing something wrong here. This is not what's going to happen like every day for the rest of our lives.
But you know what?
That moment made you change your mind to continue.
Well, funny you say that. Luckily, you know, so we basically got kicked out of a lot of restaurants because in the wine business, you know, there are service hours when you can go present your wines. We didn't know this. So we showed up, you know, during lunchtime, all confident, asking to speak with the wine buyer and getting yelled at because there's a, you know, a certain protocol that happens in the wine industry. That the wine buyers were just like, how dare you come in here at lunchtime trying to sell us stuff? Don't you know how this works? And luckily we had the foresight to say, really apologize, our bad, but we're going to leave this wine with you and here's our business card. And the next day when we were kind of just like, man, this is way harder than we thought it was going to be. Like, I don't know if we can do this. Around 2 or 3 o'clock the next day, we started to get calls, and it was from buyers from these different wine shops and restaurants where we'd lift our card, we'd lift the wine. They tried it that night and wanted us to come back in because they were interested in buying it. But I think, you know, just
we learned a lot that day.
Yeah, but you know, and every step was worth it. You know, because I feel like, you know, you can go to university, you can like talk to like, you know, so many experts, but until you decide to take the first step, until you experience it yourself, there's nothing like it. And as an entrepreneur, you know, and a lot of entrepreneurs will say this, is that your primary focus is, you know, solving problems, you know, and our problem was we had this amazing wine, you know, how are we going to get it to the wine shops and the restaurateurs? And a lot of the times you don't have the answers. You don't know, you know, the processes and how things are supposed to work, but you just have to put yourself out there and it's very uncomfortable. It's not a nice feeling to get
bloody.
and it's not a nice feeling to get yelled at, you know, in the middle of a really nice San Francisco restaurant, you know, by someone at the top of their lungs. You know, it's incredibly embarrassing, you know, but you just kind of have to like, you know, take it on the chin and know not to do it next time and figure out really quickly, like how the system works, how you can fit in, and most importantly, how you can succeed.
And what I love about all of this is something that you guys even said prior, that you had the courage to go into it because you knew you had each other. Mm-hmm. And I think the dynamic of just even having a family-owned business is even more special than just having a co-founder. Would you ever consider, say, if you guys had another business, doing it with somebody who wasn't a family member?
I think for, and I'll speak first, Robin, but I think I wouldn't go into anybody else but with my sister. And I say that, and that includes and come for me, McBride family, but that's because, you know, a lot of people say don't go into business with family. I think for Robin and I, it's a very, very unique situation in that we have very different personalities. We have very different strengths and very different weaknesses. So we end up being incredibly complementary. And like, I know at the end of the day, no matter what, my sister has my back, no matter what. Like, I don't even have to like question what type of decision she's going to make. I know it's always going to be like our family first, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Mm-hmm. And I actually see people who have other partnerships and who have co-founders and, you know, a lot of times it gets messy and, yeah. You know, I often feel like, gosh, that would be awful. I don't know if I could see myself in that type of situation where you have, you know, a person who, you know, maybe initially your goals were aligned and you knew that you both had a common vision and that all of your decisions were always going to be made in the best interest of the whole. But there's a lot of times it just doesn't work out that way. And like Andrea said, like we don't ever have that worry, that it's never a second thought. You know, she and I can operate independently in any circumstance and have complete faith that the other is operating in the best interest of both of us and for both of our families and for our family business. I couldn't imagine being in a partnership where you didn't have that 1,000%, you know,
assurance.
Secure mm-hmm. in that knowledge. Yeah.
And for us too, I think it's like, you know, a real example of that is, you know, when we started our business, Robin had just had twin boys, you know, her daughter, our niece, I think was, you know, 10 or 11. Like there were realities for her as a wife and a mother that, you know, there were priorities she had. So she couldn't like stay late. You know, there's certain things like she couldn't do, but at the time I wasn't married, you know, I didn't have a family. You know, and so I could stay late. I could go early. And now it's flip-flopped where, you know, now, you know, I'm a wife. And now I'm, you know, my daughter is 9 months old, right? So it's like, I can't stay late. You know, I can't go in early. I have these priorities. And I think that, I think when you're in a co-founder type of situation, when it's not family, you know, I think it could be maybe frustrating, you know, just because it's like,
yeah, and less sensitivity to it.
Yeah. Yeah. But, mm-hmm. you know, but saying that too, like, you know, we've seen, co-founders that aren't relatives where it works really well and they just have like a natural, sure. you know, click, a natural understanding and they operate in the same way. And we've also seen, like family, like businesses where we're like, damn, like, I hope we never end up like that. mm-hmm. You know? So, I think it all comes down to, just making sure that your personalities are complementary and that you can really truly in your heart feel like you're aligned to the same goals. And that can be hard to find.
That is true. So 15 years in, OMG, OMG. No, seriously, people don't realize, you know, entrepreneurship is one of the most creative journeys you could probably ever take in life. Lord have mercy.
Yeah. And I think,
so what would you, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and to that point, you know, it's like, you know, people see us now, and for a lot of people, maybe to them, we only have been on their radar for 2 years, and they just, in the last 2 years, they see like all of that success, all of that momentum. they didn't see the other 13 years, you know, of like blood, sweat, and tears, and, you know, all the trials and tribulations and things that, you know, took, you know, to get us to the point that we're at today.
Oh, yeah. Even at our Moguls event, Robin, I can't remember which story this was, but you basically were having a discussion about growth. And you were talking about, you know, when you have to make certain decisions. And basically the decision came down to of, are we going to pay the rent?
Right.
Like, okay, what are we doing right now that's in the best interest of this business? Are we partnering with people? Are we taking this money? Or are we paying the rent? Or we're just going to have to thug this out. And I remember you guys took the route just to thug it out because you knew it was the best decision intuitionally that you guys were just making at that moment. You're like, I'm going to trust our intuition.
Yeah.
We're just going to thug this out.
Yep.
And we're going to make it.
Yep.
That's right. And I think that was in response maybe to a question when people were talking about having investors and how to fund their business. And I think that was really when we spoke about, you know, all money is not good money. And, you know, we I don't like the term, but we bootstrapped, we self-funded, you know, for the first 13 and a half years or whatever of our business, and our success, our business grew based on our success. So we were never we didn't take on a bunch of debt. We didn't take on anyone else's money until we found, you know, what would be the right partner at the right time for us. And we see so many people who just take loads of money, lose a ton of equity
too early
and to not the right partner. And, you know, a lot of times it ends up in these kind of fly by night, you know, businesses that aren't sustainable. And the person's, the dream, the venture that they started is gone based on a decision that was made too quickly, too early.
So you guys have had very good growth and steady growth. How big is your team? Because people probably, you know, they know your numbers and stats. They're probably just like, oh, my gosh, they have 100 employees over there. But somehow you guys have figured out how to work this thing out.
Jeez. I wish I had 100 employees.
Right? We are hiring, though.
Yeah.
Check our website.
Yeah.
I did see that.
Yeah.
And you can scroll to the left. I did see that.
So currently we have 15. And by January, we're adding an additional 20 to our company.
I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's the thing is for us, just going back to like sisterhood and like the family values that we have, culture at McBride Sisters is really important. And to go back to like what Robin mentioned about, you know, we couldn't do it alone. Same thing now, you know, it takes a village to get, to take a grape, you know, to turn it into a bottle of wine. And then it takes another village to be able to get out there and sell it and create these amazing experiences, you know, for our wine lovers. So with that said, you know, we're really particular in terms of the people that we bring into the McBride Sisters family, and it needs to be a great cultural fit. So we're on this expedited timeline to try and get all these people in by January, but it's a process. So
it definitely is. It definitely is. Well, you know, I'm just in awe from now we've gone from tears to hearing the whole journey of the story. What are, I would say, a couple principles, I guess, you know, we'll do one each. That you would say for all the entrepreneurs listening, that is a very important principle that they need to apply to their lives.
I think, so this is one I think is important, is I think, because if you're an entrepreneur, you only have 24 hours in the day, and some of that should be definitely spent sleeping and eating, right? You need your fuel. But you always feel like you don't have enough time. And if you're the leader of your company and you're driving your business needs you to be doing the most important things that are going to drive revenue for your company. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, you know, when your business gets to a certain size and you kind of get in the spotlight, you can be distracted by what I would say are more ego types of activities versus what your company needs you to be doing in terms of barreling down and maybe doing the dirty work and staying in the trenches and helping generate revenue for your company. And like I can tell you, like in you know, I would say like 3 or 4 years ago, you know, I loved finally, and I'm being completely transparent. Like I love mm-hmm. finally, you know, being able to be like recognized and people could see us, and we do a lot of these interviews, and you know, we'd be sort of out there like on the road. But it took us away from the business, you know? And so like it took some like self-reflection to be like, hey, like this makes your ego feel good. But at the end of the day, like your business and the people around you need you to do, what drives revenue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and 99% of the times, that's not the sexy stuff, you know? And so I would just say, you know, just being like really aware and cognizant of what your business needs you to do in order to be successful. And then a lot of the times that's not in the spotlight, it's out of the spotlight.
It is, because 90% of what everybody does that's making an impact is what's, you know, taking place behind closed doors.
Yep.
I even told my staff, I said, for next year, I said, I will not be on these planes as much as I've been mm-hmm. previously. Mm-hmm. I was like, I need to sit still
yep.
and get some more work done. I'm like, it's real. But that is so true. That is so true. I even take social media fast now. I'll chime off for like 3 weeks at a time and then get back on.
Yep, absolutely.
So I definitely understand that. Because like I said, at the end of the day, we're still running companies and they yep. have to succeed.
Yep,
absolutely. They have to succeed. So Robin, what would you say to the entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I think it's probably really to have discipline. And I think when people think about being a business owner and starting a new venture, it's not really the discipline, I wouldn't say, is in, you know, working 20 hours a day and just doing the most and, you know, kind of wearing yourself out. I feel like people have this perception that they're doing really great if they're really busy and they don't have time to do anything else and they're, you know, doing from top to bottom, you know, in their company. But more than the busy work, I think the discipline, which Andrea and I took us probably longer than it should have to arrive at, is to stop, just like you're saying, is to stop and really evaluate how you're spending your time and really evaluate where your business is at and evaluate opportunities. One thing that Andrea and I fell victim to and still do is a great opportunity. And you really need to, before you dive headlong in something that just sounds so amazing, you know, whether it's a certain account or, you know, whatever your business is that can really get you derailed and kick you kind of, you know, off of
distracted,
what you should be focused on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Distracted. And, you know, you kind of take your eye off of the thing that's going to keep your business steadily moving forward. And if you have 10 great opportunities and you're chasing all of each of them and you're not really focusing and understanding what your core business is and where your business needs you to spend the most time, because it's exciting, right? Like, oh, we have the chance to, you know, who knows what, do something with Oprah, whatever it might be, something that's exciting. But in the meantime, you're not really building your business in a sustainable way. So if you don't have that knowledge, you know, to be able to implement the discipline, then it's to have a mentor and an advisor to bounce these things off of and to say, like, look, I've been presented with this. Should I go after that? You know, what does it look like? Because otherwise you're all over the place. You're not doing everything, you know, the best that you could, and you're not maintaining that like strong, steady growth that you need to grow your business.
That is so good. Now you also mentioned really quickly, and I know we're wrapping up, but I had to touch on this when you mentioned about mentors and advisors. With you guys being women of color coming into this space, at a very groundbreaking time, where did you seek counsel?
Yeah, we honestly, I think we're pretty lucky. I think, you know, serendipity and divine intervention always sort of like pops up in our story. But early on in our career, we were introduced to, at the time, he was the CEO and chairman of a very large wine and spirits company, the second largest of the world at the time, a company called Pernod Ricard. And he was a Frenchman. He's from France, and just super, super forward thinking. And we talked to him about our vision and where we wanted to go, and he caught it. And we call him our fairy godfather, and you know, and to this day he's on our board of directors, and has really sort of been our sort of guiding light in terms of just keeping us, like, challenging us, pushing us. A lot of the times, you know, I feel like you can have two types of mentors, somebody that just pats you on the back and can be like, yeah, you're doing great. I think for Robin and I, the type of mentor that we needed was somebody to challenge us and say, yeah, no, that's not that great. You need to make it better. You know, it's not going to work. Like, challenge yourself to, like, you know, figure this type of thing out. And he was that person for us. I think most importantly, he just had so much knowledge and expertise in the wine and spirit space that he could really, really give us credible, like, expertise, because he came with this gravitas and this swag. I mean, look, it's not easy to become a CEO of a publicly traded company, and it just fit and vibed, you know, with our personalities. And it's been one of those things that we've really treasured and we still hold dear to our hearts.
That is so dope. That is so dope. So where can everybody find you and the wine?
Oh, well, depending,
we're glad you asked.
Yeah, depending where you are in the country. So you can find us at Kroger, at Walmart, and Safeway, at Ralph's, at Fred Meyer. I'm trying to think of all the banners, Robin.
Albertsons, Bonds, Pavilion, Publix, Target.
I'm trying to think of if you're
everywhere, really. The best way to go about that is to go to McBrideSisters.com and go to our store locator and put in your zip code, and all the locations will show up.
Yes.
And where can they find you guys?
You can also buy it from us. Oh, so you can also buy it from us on our website.
Yeah.
But if it's easy to go to the store, that'll show up.
And where can they find you guys personally?
Like, on social media or?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
No, not
I was like in my house?
Like my house address?
Not at the office either. I don't know
about that.
On right social now? Media.
At McBride Sisters, everything.
So, yeah, McBride Sisters.
Not everything, just McBride Sisters.
McBride Sisters on IG, on Facebook, on Twitter.
Yes. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on here and sharing your story and your life lessons and your principles. And I'll be in touch with you guys later, because we're going to have to do something at some point soon.
Yes.
We are.
Yes.
Yes.
We see you doing all those fabulous things.
Yes.
You're so sweet.
Yes.
Well, I will talk with you guys soon, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
You too.
Thank you, Ariane. We'll talk soon.
Yes. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Fearless Podcast with Ariane Simone. Subscribe to the podcast and leave a 5-star review.